Okay. Well, I'm John Beck, and I co-direct Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. And we're very, very happy that today is kind of Lynn Nottage Day. Lynn Nottage is a playwright who got the Pulitzer Prize for this play, which is called Sweat. And today we're going to hear about that play. But tonight, Lynn Nottage is at Wharton Center doing a worldview lecture at 7:30. And that is open to everybody. Staff, faculty, and students actually can get free tickets at the box office. Everyone else has to actually pay for them, except for the extra one in my back pocket that anyone who wants it can have it at the end of this lecture. Lynn Nottage has two Pulitzer Prizes for drama now, and African-American woman who this is an exquisite play. I'll just send that around for anyone who wants to look at it while Fran is talking. And as usual, let me announce some upcoming brown bags. This is the information about Lynn Nottage and tonight's appearance at Wharton Center. This Friday, Sue Masick might be a name that's not known to all of you, but she is one of the lifetime members of a group called the Real World String Band. And the Real World String Band was one of the backbones of the anti-mountain removal campaign and movement in America, as well as doing a variety of different wonderful, wonderful labor songs in Appalachia. But Sue now does a one-woman show called Precious Memories, which is about Sarah Ogan Gunning, who actually started in Kentucky and ended her life as an old woman here in Michigan. And so Sarah Ogan Gunning was a friend of Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, and others. And so we have Sue during the day doing a brown bag on Friday over at the library. And at night, she's a 10-pound fiddle at Robin Theater downtown on Washington Street in Lansing.
10-pound fiddle still going?
10-pound fiddle is still going.
It's been a long time.
In fact, two of the originators of 10-pound fiddle are right in the house here.
Oh.
And so we're looking forward to having her here. Then Neoko Wake is talking on Friday, April 13th, while we're all finishing our taxes, I'm going to slaughter this, but it's Hibakusha in Cold War America, the Working Lives of Hiroshima and Nagasaki Survivors, and what they did here in America after that. So, and last but not least, Charlie King is coming back. Charlie King has been a presenter in our Brown Bag series, another musical Brown Bag, also at the library, on Tuesday, April 17th. Which is perfectly in line with what we have downstairs, which are our World War I exhibit. He's doing a talk slash performance slash concert called 1917, Copper, World War I and the War on Labor. Now, Charlie is a national treasure. I don't believe he's doing 10-pound fiddle that night because it's not a normal fiddle night. But Charlie's just an absolute treasure, and I would really commend that to you as well. So with that, let me introduce Fran Shore and get going on today's Brown Bag. I've known Fran for, I think, decades now, Fran.
Yes, decades. We're Fran, not going to specify the number of decades, but decades.
Decades means at least two.
At least
right?
two.
Which
at
I think it's that and maybe more. Fran Shore is a professor emeritus of history at Wayne State University and was a longtime coordinator of the North American Labor History Conference at Wayne State. Fran has done work on the industrial workers of the world and syndicalism, if I remember rightly, in Australia. Among other things, Fran can tell you more about himself. He comes to his interest in Lynn Nottage's play Sweat from two different directions, one personal, one professional. So the professional first is that Fran has been an astute observer of things in social policy and in history in relation to the city of Detroit. So he's very interested in issues of deindustrialization the weakening of the labor movement, the kind of immiseration of the working class, among other things. The personal dimension is his daughter, Miriam, was, and his wife is with him today, their daughter, Miriam, has been in the Broadway, it was off-Broadway.
It was at the Public Theater.
Yeah, in New York City.
I'll pass around the hand.
Yeah.
The playbill.
The playbill of it. So Miriam was in that specific performance for, what, a year?
Oh, it was just a couple of months. It was a limited run there.
And
yeah, and then it went to Broadway.
She couldn't do Broadway.
Yeah.
She had television.
Yeah, so she's in The Americans, if you've seen that on television. She's in a number of other television. It's wonderful to have a child in theater that actually
makes a living.
A living and doesn't have to wait tables at Junior's Cheesecake in Brooklyn. But today, Fran Shore is talking to us about Lynn Nottage's play. And the name of the talk today is Staging the Drama of Deindustrialization, Lynn Nottage's Sweat. So please help me welcome Fran Shore to our Daily Workaday Lives.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John, for having me here today. I'm very excited about seeing Lynn Nottage tonight in particular. How many people have seen or read the play? Great, great. It's an incredible play. I just read it again over the weekend, and it's very, very moving. And I'll, I will be talking obviously about the play, but of course, as a social and cultural historian, my focus on the play is not going to be a literary one. I'm really looking at the play as a kind of template or a reflection of the crisis that we've been having in this country and globally around the issue of deindustrialization. And what Lynn Nottage is able to lay bare without the kind of didacticism that sometimes can be very heavy-handed is an incredible insight into the lives of people who are going through this kind of wrenching experience. So I will be talking about the play and sort of reorganizing the play around a particular vision that I have of how to deconstruct or discuss the play with you today. Secondly, as part of being a social and cultural historian, I really want to try to give a little bit more depth to the idea of what I mean when I talk about deindustrialization and what sociologists, geographers like David Harvey, and historians mean when they talk about deindustrialization. So in effect, I'm going to give you a little bit of a theoretical preface to my discussion of the play. And I want to start with what is a very compelling book by David Harvey called Spaces of Capital. And it's a way in which many of us look at what has been a movement of capital for years that is at the root of a deindustrialization. And this is what David Harvey calls spatial fixes. One of the central contradictions of capital is that it has to build a fixed space necessary for its own functioning at a certain point in time. Hence, I can this little functioning space. But at a certain point in its history, only to have destroyed that space at a later point in order to make a way for a new spatial fix. And one way of seeing this, there are a number of books that have been written, excellent books, one by Jefferson Cowie called Capital Moves, where he traces the movement of a factory and its workers from the Midwest to the South to Mexico. And that whole, which is captured also in the play. The play makes reference to NAFTA. It makes reference to moving out to Mexico. And that's what we mean by spatial fix. That's what David Harvey means by spatial fix. But he also has two other fixes that he discusses. Technological fix, which means that automation is introduced in ways that disrupt the lives of working people. And that's the coming of robots and the coming of various kinds of technological fixes that displace workers. And a third fix he refers to is administrative fix. And that's the one where you begin to see management, for example, speed up management, demand concessions. And again, those aspects of the administrative fix also are evident in Lynn Nottage's play, Sweat. Let's see, how do I go forward again? I'm going to go. Ah, there we go. Oops, no, wrong way. All right, I'm technologically. All right. Ah, I did it again. All right, now I go.
To the right.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Takes me a little. Talk about technophobes, I'm one of them. All right, so, and again, I won't try to overload you with these concepts, but I think it's really important just to get a larger historical context on both the spatial fix and on the idea of deindustrialization itself. And a book by Beverly Silver does an incredible job of talking about a long history of spatial fixes, the movement among in global auto from various locations. And as she points out, rather than providing a permanent spatial fix to the problems of profitability and labor control, relocation has only succeeded in geographically relocating the contradictions from one side of production to another. So you move your production to Mexico, there are strikes down there by Mexican workers. And it doesn't get away from control of labor or the issue of profitability. And on the long history, again, of deindustrialization, one of the classic works now, studying in particular Detroit and the history of deindustrialization in Detroit, is Thomas Sugrue's book, The Origins of the Urban Crisis. And here he gives you the content of what is actually meant, the historical content of deindustrialization, the closing, downsizing, and relocation of plants and sometimes whole industries. And certainly Lansing and Michigan has been on the end of much of that in deindustrialization, which accelerated throughout the 20th century. Advances in communication and transportation, the transformation of industrial technology, the acceleration of regional and international economic competition, and the expansion of low-wage regions. And we know that particularly with low-wage regions being in the South and moving auto plants to the South for those low wages and for those non-unionized states. This reshaped the geography of American industrial cities. So that's a little bit, again, about what I understand and how I would see this great play in the larger context of deindustrialization and the issues of spatial fix. So I think now you have the playbill, and I want to be talking about now the staging, the drama of deindustrialization, Lynn Nottage's Sweat. And Sweat has a couple of different meanings, actually, in the play. I don't want to go into detail about that, but I think it's important to say something as I work my way through the discussion here. So Lynn Nottage's 2017 Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Sweat, brings to the stage the harsh realities and contradictions that have wreaked havoc on working class lives over decades of deindustrialization in what used to be the manufacturing heartland, and we are in that, in manufacturing heartland of America. Set in Reading, Pennsylvania, in the early years of the 21st century, there's two different time periods. The play goes back and forth at 2000 and then at 2008 after the play. Oh, spoiler alerts. If you haven't seen the play or read the play, I'm going to have to be talking about what goes on in it. So, but it doesn't spoil the overall amazing dramatic impact. So in 2008, the plant is shut down, and the devastation on the lives of the people there is very, very, very evident. Lynn Nottage herself went to Reading, Pennsylvania, and spent 2.5 years of research in the town. What I propose that I'm going to examine in this paper is how these characters illuminate what other close readers of class dynamics, Richard Sennett and Jonathan Cobb called the hidden injuries of class. That is, what actually takes a toll on workers when they have to compete in a capitalist environment? And what happens then when their lives begin to fall apart because of this deindustrialization? And this is part and parcel of the really compelling moments of this play. But I also want to talk about the racial and gender dynamics that are exacerbated by fears of jobs loss, outsourcing, and coerced concessions. Here's a picture of Lynn Nottage directing giving instructions about the play. And I happen to have found a picture of Lynn Nottage that is also of my daughter, Miriam Shore. Somebody who went to, you know, that other university in Michigan, although my oldest one went here, so okay. So I got it both covered. Lynn Nottage won a Pulitzer Prize for her off-Broadway 2009 play, like John mentioned, called Ruined, about the impact of the Civil War in the Congo on women. And again, the two different, what seemingly appear to be two very different subject matters, and yet the dynamics and the crisis and the conflict and the violence have overlaps, I think. Lynn Nottage was educated at Brown University in Yale. She's Brooklyn-born and raised, obviously, an African-American woman. And she was attracted to the dynamics of dislocation represented in the deindustrialized city of Reading, Pennsylvania. Here's Berks County. It makes reference to, in the play, Reading is the county seat of Berks County. This is in northeastern Pennsylvania. To its south, there's Lancaster. To its north is Allentown and Scranton. With 41.3% of its residents living at poverty levels. This is an astounding number, right, of people who are living at poverty levels, placing it among the lead with cities of more than 65,000. And having lost manufacturing jobs in companies such as Hershey, AT&T, Lucent Technologies, and Dana Corp, the playwright moved to Reading to excavate the human wreckage caused by such deindustrialization. With a commission from the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, where it premiered on July 29, 2015, Nottage told the Los Angeles Times that she discovered, quote, people who felt helpless, who felt like the American dream that they so deeply invested in had been suddenly ripped away. There's a song that Billy Joel wrote called Allentown, which also talks a little bit about that dislocation, again, in another Pennsylvania manufacturing city. I was sitting with these white men and I thought, you sound like people of color in America. And in fact, as I'll point out, in the work of Jonathan Jest, Justin Jest, who did a study of Youngstown, Ohio, he talks to workers there. And in his study of the white working class in deindustrialized Youngstown, he calls this process by which people have lost status and have been dislocated because of transformations in the economy, he calls it minoritization, a decline in their numbers, a dramatic loss in their status, and a feeling that other and ethnic racial groups are gaining social advantage at their expertise. And this, of course, is what obviously drove some of the white working class vote for Donald Trump, this kind of minoritization. He also, in his book, talks about post-traumatic cities. I think a lot of us inhabit some of those post-traumatic cities, where the exurbs and urban areas that lost signatures industry in the mid to late 20th century and never really recovered. On the other hand, while Sweat explores these ethnic and racial tensions, especially through the interactions of the play's white, black, and Hispanic characters, Nottage locates both the moments of working class solidarity and its explosive limitations. So there are moments when you see the kind of camaraderie that often develops, and she uses the bar as a main scene for that camaraderie. And anybody who's, John was mentioning the bar up in Escanaba, that was a place when I worked on the south side of Pittsburgh in the what used to be Jones and Laughlin Steel Mill, you could always go at lunchtime and know that they had already set up shots and beers for the workers to coming out of the factory. Then it was what we would call Iron City and Imp, Iron City and Imperial Whiskey. And those shots and beers were already lined up on the bars just to help lubricate that camaraderie. And of course, in tension, in times of tense dislocation, it worked in the opposite direction. This is part of the playbill that I sent around. In particular, the performance that I saw at the public theater in New York City in the fall of 2016 brought to the stage a riveting range of gender, class, and racial dimensions that I can only explore in a rather incomplete manner, especially since I want to encourage others to see or read the play. Indeed, what I intend to do is represent Sweat in two acts, each dedicated to highlighting the two gender triadic relationships within which certain class and racial conditions and contradictions obtain, with an epilogue that highlights the very real injuries of class suffered by the two other characters. The three women characters, here's Cynthia, a middle-aged African-American, Tracy, a middle-aged white woman of German descent, and Jessie, my daughter Miriam Shore, performed by my who is a middle-aged Italian-American, were all born in Berks County, Pennsylvania. So they're all locals. I mean, and as I said, Lynn Nottage researched this and interviewed lots of locals. They are also co-workers in a fictional factory facing job losses and a potential shutdown. Added to the stress is the possibility of an opening for a supervisory position for which both for which both Tracy and Cynthia apply. And this is going to lead to some real tension, particularly between these two who are longtime friends. Even though Tracy and Cynthia have been friends for years, the promotion of Cynthia to what Tracy calls a friggin' cushion of a job produces a breach in their friendship, a breach further exacerbated by what Cynthia believes is Tracy's collusion with management and ultimate betrayal. And so you get, I remember I had a student in my class I used to teach.
Cynthia's collusion with management rather than
Tracy's. Yes, oh sorry. Tracy is saying that Cynthia is colluding because Cynthia took this position and felt that she was betraying. And I know I had when I was teaching a class, one of the union locals in the old Cadillac assembly plant, I had a really bright student who was bumped up to being not management, but he was a committeeman. And after a couple of months, he just said he couldn't take it anymore. I mean, because that's one of the things that Capital did as an administrative fix. You put the committeemen in between to really deal with all the grievances and make them the real problem. And here, I think this is what I want to stress and underline, because I think this is a key to understanding these social and psychological dynamics that go on in the play. In turning people against each other, the class system of authority and judgment making goes itself into hiding. The system is left unchallenged as people enthralled by the enigmas of its power battle one another for respect. Now, sometimes the system is very clearly evident, and people in solidarity fight the system. Other times, however, it often operates as a kind of very much invisible hand, not the one that Adam Smith was talking about, but one that does cause incredible damage. For Cynthia, however, her promotion to supervisor is based on the humiliation she feels she suffered over the years as a line worker and as African-American woman. Indeed, in her defense against the charges of betrayal from Tracy, Cynthia remonstrates, "I've stood on that line, same line since I was 19. I've taken orders from idiots who were dangerous, or even worse, racist. But I stood online, patiently waiting for a break. I don't think you get it. But if I walk away, I'm giving up more than a job. I'm giving up all the time I spent standing online, waiting for one damn opportunity." For Cynthia, the status and money provided by becoming a supervisor captures what Michel Lamont, in a great sociological study about the working class, writing about the differences between male, white, and black workers, identifies as, quote, "a passport that can trump their racial stigma." Nonetheless, the passport for Cynthia leads to a bitter dead end. As the play fast forwards from 2000, when this action takes place, to 2008, both Cynthia and Tracy are victimized by the displacement caused by the plant closing and its move to Mexico, a move that historians and social scientists of deindustrialization, like Jefferson Cowie, Beverly Silver, David Harvey, Tom Segru, and others, have tracked, which reflects the spatial fix that I pointed out a little bit earlier. Those left behind, like Cynthia and Tracy, have to confront the hardships left by capital's spatial fix, either jobless poverty and opioid addiction, which is Tracy's problem that we see in 2008. So this is not a comedy. This is a tragedy. But it's a tragedy that reflects the incredible reality of the expansion of opioid addiction, what it's done in the lives of people, particularly in the working class, but not exclusively there. Or in the case of Tracy, where she has to work at two low-paying non-union jobs just to make a living. And again, that's also part of that kind of displacement that we see happening under deindustrialization. The third woman in this triangle of wrecked friendship and lives is Jessie, who represents the dreams of an escape never realized. Instead of fantasies of becoming an owner of a small business, something that social scientists studying male auto workers from Eloy Chinoy to Ruth Milkman to Victor Tan Chen underscore, Jessie's hippie-inflected global trek from Indian ashram to, quote, and here this is the mantra she sort of, in her sometimes alcoholic stupor, repeats over and over again, which is underscored by the irony of what the history now. Istanbul, Tehran, Kandahar, Kabul, Peshawar, Lahore, Kathmandu. And now if we think how Kandahar, Kabul have been completely almost decimated by the 17-year-long war that the United States has imposed on that region. This reflects not only Jesse's sense of a lost personal opportunity, but ironically, a lost world absent the conflict that have engulfed all the Middle Eastern and Asian cities cited by Jesse. In a wistful recollection of her aborted plans, Jesse laments, quote, "I wish I had gotten to see the world. You know, left Berks only for a year. That's what I regret, not the work. I regret the fact that for a little while it seemed like, I don't know, there was possibility," unquote. For Jesse, the possibility was eliminated by class and gender constraints and then reduced to alcohol-fueled reverie. From women on edge to men on the edge. Here, Stan, the bar owner, who worked in the plant for 25 plus years and had an injury that allowed him to escape. We see Tracy's son, Jason, confronting Oscar, who's a native-born, but born in the United States, but of Colombian background. And Oscar was working help in the bar, and there's going to be, and this triangle in particular added to Chris, Cynthia's son, is going to be involved in the ultimate denouement, the climatic tragedy of the play. The three men captured by what will become an explosive triangle are Jason, the 20-something son of Tracy, that's Jason again over here, Chris, who we don't see in this picture, the 20-something son of Cynthia, who both work at the factory as their mothers do, and Oscar, who we see here, a 20-something Columbia American who aspires to get a job in the same plant. And again, his father had been able to get a job in the plant, but a non-union job sweeping up the floors. And again, you see the way in which immigrants are marginalized, the system plays one group of people off another group of people. You remember that famous saying by the robber baron of the late 19th century, Jay Gould, I get one half of the working class to kill off or fight off the other half of the working class. Well, this play also dramatizes that really explosively. Oscar's aspiration and realization of working in the factory will set off the fireworks of the dramatic confrontation pitting Jason and Chris against Oscar, which results in a violent brawl that has unintended repercussions for the three and for Stan. Again, reading it over, it's really gut-wrenching. It's a very moving play. And you know, it brings me to brought me to tears when I saw it on stage, and brought me to tears when I was just reading it over again. When Oscar leaves his job at the bar to become a scab in the factory, Jason, pushed along by anti-immigrant and racial resentments, stoked in turn by his mom almost becoming a Lady Macbeth at a certain point, vows to get, and excuse the language, but this is the language of the play, harsh as it is, to get that fucking spick. Egging on her son, Tracy, almost Lady Macbeth-like, denounces Oscar for, quote, eating your dinner, your steak and potatoes, your fucking dessert, unquote. Capturing the anti-immigrant attitudes that would fuel the right-wing populism mobilized by Donald Trump. And by the way, Trump won Berks County by almost 18,000 votes. Obama, however, won Berks County in 2008. So you can see that kind of transformation that, again, is exacerbated by these job losses. You could hear people talk about, well, I'm going to vote, this is Roseanne, and her, well, I'm going to vote for her because he's going to give me jobs. You know, he promised jobs. And of course, he also used immigrant scapegoating, and that's been part of it, which is in the play. Jason later recognizes that the blind fury that led to the violent confrontations, a fury that I ain't been able to shake, Jason says, as he faces life as an ex-con and an unemployed worker. Jason's remorse is part of a larger dynamic that has a number of complex levels to it. One that Mike King talks about, of aggrieved whiteness. The sense, again, I've been made a minority. These people are taking my job. How come we're always left out? And in fact, there are now studies that show many people in the white community believe they're more discriminated against than those in more marginalized communities. So aggrieved whiteness is a white identity politics aimed at maintaining white socio-political hegemony through challenging efforts to combat actual material racial inequality while supporting heavily racialized investments in policing, prisons, and the military, and appositing a narrative of anti-white racial oppression loosely rooted in an assortment of racialized threats. And even though Cynthia and Tracy and Jason Chris are friends, of longtime friends, the dynamic that sweeps them up, the vortex into which they're pulled, the sense of I'm white and damn it, I'm still entitled to something, as opposed to how do we work this all out and challenge the system, that brings everybody down. And it brings them down in a way that Victor Chan, I think, remarkably pierces when he discusses what's going on in the lives of auto workers in the Michigan area and in the Windsor area. He compares and contrasts them, actually, interestingly, about who has a greater social safety net to help mitigate some of these feelings of shame and self-blame. Shame is a state of pain, discomfort, and stigma arising from one's perceived unworthiness and low status. And this is a key to what Lynn Nottage discusses in the play, and the counselor who you see, an African-American man at the beginning of the play, toward the end of the play, who also reminds them that shame is a driving factor. It brings about a sense of oneself as a social outcast. Self-blame or guilt, on the other hand, implies that the individual could have avoided a wrong action. However, when shame and self-blame are combined, they create a particularly toxic condition. And this is what, in particular, you see Jason grappling with, and even Chris to some extent, although he tends to have a lean on something that saves him, redeems him at a certain level, which is the religion. So it is. When Marx talked about it as the opiate of the masses, he also, in that longer quote, made very clear that it also deals with the suffering of masses. It's a way to contend with that. So it's not just what we understand by the truncated quote from Marx. While drawn into dramatic violence scene at the bar, and here I wanted to include another bar from a recent National Geographic. Missing the past, Bob Sacco tends bar a few days a week at Hazleton's Alter Street. Hazleton's another city in eastern Pennsylvania that's gone through this kind of economic dislocation like Reading did, where many storefronts are now Latino-owned businesses, and there's been an increase, a very strong increase in the number of Latinos in a lot of these areas. The old crowd laments that the area's newer employers, such as distribution centers that don't have unions, that don't pay union wages, don't provide the kind of pay or benefits that workers when found at the mines and factories closed decades ago. So that long-term downward spiral that happens in deindustrialization, particularly with the displacement of factories and jobs that were good-paying jobs, the displacement into non-unionized work, service centers, all of this creates its own wreckage in its place. On the other hand, well, here's this dramatic scene. Chris is motivated by another desire, one built in getting an education that will take him out of the factory, perhaps into a white-collar occupation. Unfortunately, Chris, like Jason, has to contend with standing up to the factory bosses by joining his working class comrades in a strike to put a stop to any further concessions and job losses. So they go out on strike, and they go out on strike realizing that they're being replaced by scab workers. Among those scab workers, and again, historically, what's often happened is the use of those people who have been on the outs and haven't been able to get into the plants, and that wonderful, great film, called Matewan gives you another understanding of how that displacement, how all that works. Here's Chris saying, again, once you get into this kind of masculinist pose, and maybe even toxic masculinity, Chris even gets drawn into this vortex, as he says in the play, I'm not going to be a punk-ass bitch. That's what they want. So this is often not only seen in class terms, it's seen in gender terms. And it has a major impact often in those gender terms. On the other hand, Oscar, who will become the object of Chris and Jason's wrath because of his strike breaking, interprets his actions also through the lens of macho posturing, but one based on ethnic racial realities of discrimination and exclusion. Quote from Oscar here. What they're offering us is better than anything I've touched since I got out of high school. So, yo, I ain't afraid to cross the line. Let me puff up their chest, but it don't scare me no more than walking through my hood. I know rough. I ain't afraid to roll in the dirt. Unquote. Unfortunately for him,
The role in the dirt has irreparable repercussions for all three young men and one other. That other, Stan, a former factory worker who now manages the bar that is a meeting place for all the action in 2000 and 2008, is doubly victimized. His first injury is the result of the neglect by management of faculty machinery in the factory. Although angry at the lack of sympathy by management for his injury, Stan does see the benefit of leaving his 28 years of factory work behind. Quote, getting injured was the best thing that ever happened to me. Got me out of the vortex. Three generations on the floor, and here you got this long-term history of these generations who worked in these plants here. So the displacement is not just for them. It's not just an immediate physical displacement or social displacement. It's a long-time displacement of their own identity. Loyal as hell, I never imagined working anywhere else. Stan's recollections are part of a dialogue with Brucey, the father of Chris, former husband of Cynthia, and another injured, more psychologically than physically, former worker at another plant. In the following soliloquy, Brucey highlights not only his family's historical struggle to gain a foothold in the American dream, but also the continuing divisive effects of the inter-working class blame game. This is a term that Lynn Nottage uses, and I'm sure very aware of what those dynamics are, not knowing whether, and I'll ask her tonight, did you read Hidden Injuries of Glass? last week, this is Brucey again, I was at the union office signing up for some bullshit training, and this old white cat, whatever, gets in my face talking about how we took his job. I asked him who he was talking about, and he pointed at me. So I said, if you ain't noticed, I'm in the same fucking line as you. Hello? You think that would shut him down? But no, he's a scratch in the vinyl, going on and on about us coming here and ruining everything, like I'm fresh off the boat or some shit. He don't know my biography. October 2nd, 1952, my father picked his last bale of cotton. He packed his razor and his Bible and headed north. 10 days later, he had a job at Dixon's Hosieries. He clawed his way up from a fifth of the yard to union rep, fighting for assholes just like that cat. And again, that whole trip, that traverse, that second great migration of African Americans from the Deep South. I mean, those were many of the students I taught who were in UAW locals around Detroit, you know, whose family was still back in Alabama or Mississippi or Georgia, or the white workers who came from Appalachia, from Tennessee, from Kentucky. Hell, we even call it Ipsitucky, don't we? Or in Hazeltucky in Detroit for Hazel Park. As Sennett and Cobb note, the burden of class creates a logic of discontent that leads people to turn on each other rather than on the system. And this play so dramatically and tragically reveals that and gives us, I think, a better understanding of why we need to transform the system itself. This system, fully revealed in all its intersectional injuries through Lynn Nottage's sweat, still confounds those of us who, as historians, social scientists, and our union and community activists, must address the performative dynamics that shape the drama of deindustrialization. Thank you.
Hooked up here. I have plenty of questions, but let me open it up first. Questions or comments? And I'm sorry that the play, we were hoping, actually, based on last Tuesday's performance of a few of the acts at Local 652, the play is now going to the regional theaters.
Oh, yeah, I know, right.
And
right.
So the hope is that it would actually come maybe to Michigan at some point, and it would be wonderful if we could actually get it at the Wharton. And it's unfortunate that you all have not seen it, but I think Fran's
done
a good job of setting up the notion of what's going on. And it is, in effect, a Michigan story in its own way, even if it's set in Pennsylvania.
Right.
So with that, questions or comments on the whole notion of deindustrialization, on playing out deindustrialization? Before I ask a couple of my questions, any comments? Well, let me, you know, I think that it's interesting, Fran, having gone through this, in my case, with the paper workers, where we had a number of locations that rural poverty by its very nature is tough. And
right.
if you have a very, very wonderful paper mill and it closes, it's the only game in town.
Right, exactly.
And there you go. But I always use a term that I think maybe you're really talking about, and that is the notion that even if we think globally that all suffering is local, that is, it's local and it's personal.
Right.
And there's kind of an illusion that I'd love to have you talk about. There's an illusion of mobility. That is, that we can simply leave to you know, go back down south, or we can leave to go somewhere else. But I assume that you really believe, maybe as I do, that that mobility is an illusion. That is, that only so many people, in effect, get
right.
out.
Right.
Not unlike that line in The Godfather, I try to get out and they keep
pulling
back in. You know?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, John. A couple of different responses to it. In the play itself, when Stan and Jason are talking, and Stan realizes that Jason is really out to get Oscar,
yeah.
Jason at some point says, you know, maybe I could go to work on those oil rigs, down south. And Stan said, that's a great idea. You shouldn't be hooked into this area. You don't have to, you know, you should just take up and go. But you realize when many of these families have generations where they've been in that city, and in particular, there's that very moving soliloquy by Tracy about her grandfather, who was a German immigrant, who built things as a craftsperson with his hands and used to take her around as his granddaughter to the buildings where he built all these things. So that sense of place and that sense of identity is very, very strong. It provides not only a kind of web that does make it more difficult for people to break out, but I think it means that people, when they take up and move somewhere else, they uproot more than just their home, and they uproot a very strong sense of place. Secondly, a lot of times, and I've heard this from workers who would say, okay, this plant closed, they want to send me to Elkhart, Indiana, or they want to send me somewhere else. You know, I don't know if I want to go there. I mean, it's not particularly a place I know or feel comfortable with, and even though they're going to give me the same job, so there are other prohibitions that I think are partly psychological, that are also part of a larger social network that make it difficult. And one of the things, to go back to Thomas Sugrue too, because it does fuel some of this resentment also about having to make place for newly arrived people. In Sugrue's The Origins of the Urban Crisis, he mentions the largest working class movement in the 1950s in Detroit was what? It was the housing movement of white workers who didn't want blacks to move into their neighborhoods. And many of them, as I think Sugrue does a really excellent job of looking at the nuances, he said, look, many of them lived in Catholic parishes. They didn't want to leave those Catholic parishes. And they felt somehow threatened, over and above whatever racial resentment was carried, threatened by the fact that their home, that their housing prices might go down, there might be a further dislocation. So the idea that, you know, you can just take up and leave, that kind of geographical mobility, which has been part and parcel of American history. There's always moving west, there's always going west, that's the, getting somewhere, lighting out for the frontier, as Huck Finn would say. You know, there's always that, but it doesn't pertain in all circumstances, especially when people have this rooted sense of status and class.
Other comments or questions? Dorothy?
Well, you know, she took the play, Lynn, and I think she'll talk about this tonight. She took it back to Reading, and she showed it, and they performed to the folks in Reading, Pennsylvania, with the cast from the public. And it was a very moving experience, both for the cast and the people in the audience. So on one hand, you may be right, you know, when somebody says, oh, man, we just got the weekend, I just want to sit back, watch a baseball game. Maybe see the Tigers finally win, as opposed to going to some dramatic thing. But I think in the case of, like in Reading, Pennsylvania, in the case where John just took the play to one of the locals here, you know, people, when they see that their lives are presented, even if it might be difficult moments in their lives on stage, they respond positively to it. I think it
not depressed.
They can work through it if there's a good talk back. You know, on the other hand, you know, most Broadway plays are not even going to be within working class budgets. You know, they're very expensive anymore, and Broadway's tried to make it available to, you know, bring kids in from poorer areas of the city so that they can have this experience of the stage. And this, you know, there are many different ways to illuminate the lives of people. And I think in all the critical responses, and the reason that she won the Pulitzer for this and won a Tony, is all of those East Coast critics realize the heartland is, you know, there's a lot of pain out there. And people have to be reminded of it so that we deal with the issues that have caused that kind of pain. Whether it's somebody saying, you know, well, let's go see this play at the public, or, you know, I mean, the audiences weren't necessarily working class audiences that my wife and I saw when we went to the public, but at least the public is in a little bit more manageable monetary range for tickets. I think it was. Well, we got free tickets, I know.
Well, then it's really manageable when you get free tickets.
Really.
Well, but to Dorothy's point, I think that Dorothy, that you're correct, that one thing that has been said by cultural historians is that television replaced religion as the opiate of the people.
Right.
So that the question is, do people want to go somewhere and see a play about themselves? Or do they want to sit home and watch the Kardashians in whatever new version that they have? And there's an interesting kind of tension around that. And I don't think that there's any question that, for example, the kind of audience that you might see at Sweat is going to have a tendency to be older and more affluent than
right.
the people who are being presented
right.
in the play. And so, by its very nature, that's kind of an ongoing problem. I'm reminded that the first time I ever borrow a video camera and had it at home, and my mother came in and suddenly saw herself on our television. And she stopped dead, and she looked at it and said, "Oh my God, I look so old." Okay. And what was interesting about that is the whole notion of once we actually to use the term, see ourselves plain in relation to something, it can be disconcerting,
right.
Okay? And that the same thing is true, you know, as to whether or not someone cleans up our language if we do oral histories with them and then they,
right.
I mean, with us, and then they clean up our language. There's always kind of a tension. But I want to get
let me,
to...
Let me, if I can, yeah. I just want to piggyback on that, because that's also a really interesting question from the perspective of a long-term cultural history perspective. And that is that in the 19th century, in the mid-19th century, early 19th century, in the United States in particular, the idea that there was a difference between high culture and low culture didn't really yet exist. to the extent that it did at the beginning of the 20s, as it moved into the 20th century. And what you would have is workers would go see Shakespearean plays. Yeah. I mean, they would often go and clap. We want to hear the same soliloquy over and over again. So the play was, the dynamic of the play was very different. And they often took a very nationalistic view towards who would be playing those parts. So when a British actor, there were riots at the theater because this British actor was trying to play Shakespeare instead of an American actor. But, you know, these were workers going to hear Shakespeare because it was seen as part of the legacy and part of their, you know, their world. In the 1930s, I think there was a recreation of that kind of sense of worker-related theater, that theater could be a tool for, you know, for either from Clifford Odets and playwrights like that, could have see their lives on stage. And, you know, that actually was something that was very much part and parcel of the upsurge of what's called the Popular Front in the 1930s.
But, I mean, it's the same debate as to when Roseanne first arrived on television, the portrayal of the working class. When the Cosby Show hit TV, the idea that the most popular possible treatment of African Americans was really this was a revered local doctor rather than necessarily the other things that African Americans might do occupationally. Right. And so there's a tension, and the tension is, by the way, in literature, because Will Rogers once said that God must have loved the common people because he made them so many of them.
Right.
And then the conservative Philip Wiley came out a few years later and said, no, God must have hated the common people because he made them so common. So, you know, there's an ongoing tension always. But let me get it to, you raised something about Donald Trump, and one of the most famous cartoons, or jokes actually, was not a cartoon, was that an employer comes in the room and there's a black worker and a white worker, and there's a plate of 6 cookies on the table. And the employer takes 5 cookies, puts them in his own pocket, then looks at the white worker and says, you better watch out for that black worker because he's going to take your cookie. And so I think there's an immediate kind of visceral response to the whole notion of pitting people against immigrants, pitting people against others in terms of race.
Right.
But it's interesting from, I think, the point of view that what you often get is this feeling of, is this what I get for my hard work and loyalty?
Right.
That is
right.
Believing that somehow that you've been shunted aside like a tool that is no longer worthwhile.
Right.
And that aggrieved whiteness, I think, is the way that you describe that. Let me get to self-blame for a minute, because I think everybody might have a comment on this, that there's this whole notion that if an asteroid hits the Earth, that somebody's going to say, oh my God, what could I have done differently in my life to stop this from happening, right? So the same thing is true in terms of plant closure, that often people say, you know, what could we have done differently, you know, and there is that kind of self-blame kind of situation. One of the plants that we worked with here at Michigan State was Lifesaver over in Holland, Michigan. And when Lifesaver closed, the local union asked the company, what could we have done to save this plant? And the company had to explain to them that it was all about the price of sugar in Canada. And that the price of sugar in Canada was so low, and since Lifesavers were made primarily out of sugar, after all, they said, you could have worked for free, and we couldn't keep this plant open.
Profitability, right.
Okay. So the issues of profitability, and I think that whole notion of hard work and loyalty, people feeling betrayed
right.
because of what they put into a plant over, or any kind of employment over a period of years. Other comments from folks or questions about that? Does that tally with people's kind of feelings and experience? Because I think that whole notion And a little historic footnote for you, Fran, you probably know it, but when Youngstown Sheet and Tube was originally the judge in that case stayed the actual destruction of the mill. And Judge Lambros claimed that there was something that he at least tentatively put on the legal docket in relation to the plant. He said that, and I would call it what I think he had a different term for it, but it's basically that he believed that the employer owed more to the workers than simply what they had already gotten in the way of wages and benefits.
Right.
And he implied that there was what might be called a sweat equity, a property right to a job.
Right.
And so that's really what comes up in sweat and other kinds of similar plant closure kinds of situations.
In fact, during the 1950s, when Ford was beginning at the Rouge plant, very big Rouge plant, Local 600, was beginning to ship jobs out. The local, then dominated by left-wing forces, undertook a suit led by Ernie Goodman, famous left lawyer in Detroit, on exactly that basis, challenging Ford's essential violation of the spirit of the contract, that this was a violation of what commitment had been made to the workers. And the voice that you hear, particularly in the play, is Stan, because the bartender, who was injured and goes back to that injury and says, nobody ever came to me when I was in the hospital. Nobody really ever apologized for all the work I put in, and what happened to me. And how did they reward loyalty? Nobody really understands sweat. I mean, he uses that reference too, how much he had to sweat in that plant previously. And so that's very much captured what is really the belief in that kind of sweat equity. And
another aspect of this that I'm familiar with is young men still living at home with their parents. Mm-hmm. And I happen to know one family well. And he takes, and even though he's a college graduate with a master's degree, he takes manual labor type jobs in the Lansing area.
Yeah.
But has to live at home with his.
Yeah, because of the low wages that he's receiving. And at the end of the play, Jason, goes to his mother, Tracy, and Chris goes to his mother, Cynthia. There's a more welcoming reception by Cynthia to Chris that he could move back in, whereas the clash between Jason and his mom, Tracy, is so much greater. She's in this. With this opioid addiction, he's still riven by what had happened and sent him to prison and still comes out all tatted with the tats of the Aryan Brotherhood. So there's these kinds of incredible dynamics that are going on too. And now, just because of so many service jobs that are available that don't pay that well, kids are sticking around and staying longer, living at their families' homes out of almost economic necessity, because it's they might not be able to afford all of the things that go with having your own residence and your own paying your own bills and having your own car and having all of those sorts of things.
So, any last question or comment from folks? Let's give Fran another round of applause. Thank you so much.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming out. And we're 2 days away. I had want to take this opportunity. We're 2 days away from the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King, who I certainly revered and met. And I wrote a little piece the other day that I think reminds us of Dr. King's message about war and violence, but also connects it up with the incredible, hopefully awakening that's happening led by young people around the issue of gun violence. So I'll just consider this a little, another thing to read, but a little gift for, from, parting gift from Dr. King. From,
well, we don't have a board edition, board game edition of our Daily Work of Daily Lives, so we haven't had parting gifts up till now. So please, everyone, come to the last three brown bags of the year this Friday, then the 13th, and then the 17th, and thank you for being part of our Daily Work of Daily Lives.